all they really wanted to do was win the race. And it came to it made me realize after a while how powerful this can be and how detrimental it can be when you're in the middle of a race and you're looking at your splits thinking, oh, that's too fast or that's too slow or I'm not feeling good for this pace. I think that can have a huge impact on how you actually feel.
That track from Soap, 195. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Matt Fox, who is the founder of Sweat Elite, that I'm sure many of you will be familiar with. But for those of you who aren't, we go into what that is in the interview. In short, we discuss the training patterns and habits of the world's best runners and the methodologies of the world's best running coaches. And this includes runners like Eliud Kipchoge, Mo Farah, David Rudisha, and coaches like Renato Canova in particular, but also we discuss Arthur Lydiard a little bit and Alberto Salazar, who is Mo Farah's coach. Before we get into the interview, however, big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Precision Hydration. I just recently listened to Chris McCormack's Macca's audiobook, his autobiography, I'm Here to Win. And that was a great book that I highly recommend, by the way. In it, he talks about his struggles in Kona, specifically with nutrition and hydration, and how it took him a really long time and hanging out with bodybuilders and discussing with them to figure out the hydration and electrolyte equation. And when he started actually preloading with electrolytes, that's when he started to sort those things out, because he was a bigger guy. He had a big sweat rate and probably lost a lot of electrolytes as well. So that's when he started to actually avoid cramps that he used to get every single year in Kona. And unfortunately for him, Precision Hydration wasn't around when he first started racing in Kona, but now they are. So you can benefit from their free online sweat test, which is a simple quiz that you can take in a few minutes' time on precisionhydration.com. That will give you a free strategy for your next race, and it will tell you how much electrolytes you should consume. And that strategy will be based on a great estimate of your sweat rate and sweat sodium content. Until the end of August, you can get 20% off your Precision Hydration orders with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW20. And if you have never used a PH before, then you can try your first box or tube for free with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Go to precisionhydration.com and check them out. And thank you to Roka. Roka are really proud of the fact that every product they build is thoughtfully designed and rigorously tested and meticulously perfected. Roka's employees are athletes themselves, so they're always trying to solve real-world problems that they face to ensure that they and us are ready on race day. And now they're bringing attention to the fine details of their products in a campaign called Details Matter. So in the coming episodes, you'll hear what some of the fine details that the people that are actually working at Roka, who are, as I said, athletes themselves, find are the all-important small details that can make a big difference. And this week, I highlight a detail that comes from Mark at Product Design. It's about the Maverick wetsuits. And Mark writes, I loved the discovery of the fit numbers printed on the wetsuits. There is a 1 at the knee, a 2 at the elbow joint, and a 3 for the top of the shoulder. And these numbers subtly make sure that I have the suit positioned correctly for the best fit possible. No more worrying if I have the suit on properly. I simply check that numbers align. So that's a great one. I had not noticed that, so it was good to find that out, to make sure that I put it on properly when I do next time. I'll make sure to do that. You can get 20% off your entire order on roka.com with the promo code TTS, and Roka is roka.com. Without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Matt Fox from Sweat Elite. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How about yourself?
Very good as well. Excited for this talk. Sweat Elite is a website, a blog that I've been following for quite some time, and I'm one of your subscribers. But for those listeners that may not be aware, what is Sweat Elite? Can you give the introduction of what it is, what you do, and how you started it?
Yeah, sure. So I guess what most people that or what subscribers and people that follow Sweat Elite know it as is it's a website or a company, should I say, because we share a lot of information off our website on social media about elite running training methods. When I say running training, it sort of starts at the sprints all the way through to the ultra marathon distance, but the most of the information is based around sort of middle distance, 800 meters, 1500 meters through to the marathon. So that's what most people know it for, and that's what initially it was started for. That's since branched out to also include coaching, training plans, and we're also even doing some training camps to Kenya. And those additional things only really came as a result of demand, a lot of people asking for them over time. But for the first, I guess, just under 2 years of running Sweat Elite, it was predominantly just sharing elite running training methods and insights. And in the methods, it also sort of includes information on diet, strength training, even articles and sections of ebooks on altitude training and so on. So it's sort of, if you want to look at, for example, Eliud Kipchoge, the best marathoner of all time, or Mo Farah, and you want to know absolutely every aspect of what they do in training, I guess you can find that information on the Sweat Elite website.
And what does your team look like? How many people do you have working, writing articles and doing all the things that you do?
Yeah, it's a surprisingly small team. I started it myself almost 3 years ago now. It was just me and one other person at the time, and now it's five of us. So it's myself, three people writing, although two people write on more of a regular basis. One writes for occasionally, and then one programmer who does all of the tech stuff. And I basically just manage those four and just make sure it pieces together. And I also do all the marketing and social media marketing and essentially everything to do with the internet marketing is what I do. Yeah. So yeah, it's just five of us at the moment. We are looking to, it's actually very fortunate that you invited me to come on the show, because we would like to expand our triathlon at some point very soon. We actually have been trying to for a while. We just haven't sort of found the right person or people to help us do that. So, you know, when I heard it, when you invited me to come on the podcast, I was excited about the opportunity, because triathlon is a space that I've been interested in for a while. I'm a runner myself, but I know quite a lot of triathletes, and some of the listeners of this show may remember an athlete called Brad Cullerfelt from Australia who was quite good through sort of 2004 to 2012. I lived with him for quite a while, and I actually he had Jan Frodeno come and stay with him for about 6 months in 2007, the year before he won the Olympics, and I was living with Jan at the time. And at the time, he wasn't such a big name at the time. Of course, he was one of Germany's best triathletes, but it was before he won that Beijing Olympics. So I've always sort of had a bit of an in with triathlon. Although, as I said, I'm not a triathlete myself, but I know a few top guys, so I want to branch out into that space at some point soon.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because I remember that in some of your emails some time ago, you have mentioned that you're looking to maybe expand in triathlon. So that will be exciting when it happens. But even before that, endurance sports is very similar across the board. There are some nuances to the different disciplines, of course, but the main principles remain the same, which is why triathletes can learn from cyclists, runners, swimmers, and vice versa. So we're going to focus on the running part, but a lot of the things that we'll discuss, I'm sure, will apply very well to triathlon in general, but to the other disciplines as well, to swimming and cycling.
For sure. Absolutely agree with that. Yeah. So as I said, as you just pointed out, I've been purely had my head in the running space for the last 3 years. So everything on the Sweat Elite website at the moment is running. But as you said, you know, a lot of it can be applied to the other realms as well.
Yeah. So if we start with this, you have such a wealth of information on the website. If somebody new comes to the website, what are your top three or five things that you've found across the board when it comes to the information that you put together? I guess the top three to five advice that you would give or commonalities among the world's best runners and coaches that you've found.
Yeah, sure. Well, when I knew that you were going to ask a question like this, it was actually a little bit of a different one to answer, simply because, you know, in triathlon, the distances for running tend to be, when you're talking about Olympic distance through to Ironman, I guess, which are the most popular tri distances, the running is predominantly aerobic. But we've been studying training methods of runners from sprints all the way through the distance. So the philosophies are obviously very different. The training methods are very different. But one thing I have noticed across the board that is very similar amongst all of the very, very elite athletes, because I've been very fortunate enough to actually spend time training with a lot of them, or just if I'm not training physically with them, I'm just watching them. They all have very almost playful and very motivating training environments. So they'll turn up to training, they'll have at least sort of 5 or 10, or in Eliud Kipchoge's case, 30 or 40 other athletes that are very motivated as well. But, you know, the coach is obviously very knowledgeable. So they turn up and they're within this sort of bubble where they're just surrounded by athletes that are just as motivated as they are, or obviously similar. And they also tend to not take it too seriously as well. So, for example, I was in Ethiopia earlier this year, and Mo Farah was training with his training camp, and I was at the track just before he was getting started his track session. He was kicking the football around with the guys in his training group. You know, of course, he wasn't risking injury by doing anything crazy, but he was just having a laugh, having a play, talking about, I think it's Arsenal that he's a big fan of. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but he's a big fan of...
I think you're right. I'm an Arsenal fan as well, and I do remember that.
Okay. Yeah, well, he was just talking nonstop about the game that he watched the other night, and they were having a laugh. And it was very similar when I went to train with David Rudisha. And those who don't know David Rudisha, he's the 800-meter Olympic champion and world record holder. He has a very similar training environment, surrounded by very talented and motivated people. They're having a laugh at the start of training sessions. They're having a joke. They're not taking it too seriously. Kipchoge is exactly the same. Usain Bolt, I haven't trained with Usain Bolt, but I know people that have, and I've watched videos. Very similar. They all have that in common. If I could think of anything, because of course you can't look at Usain Bolt and Wayne Van Niekerk and Eliud Kipchoge's training. They're obviously training for completely different events, but that's one thing they definitely have in common that was almost a little bit surprising to me. How can I put it? Like, they weren't too serious about training when they were there. Of course, they trained very hard, and when the whistle went off and they started the intervals, they were dead serious about what they were doing, but they were just having a good time and making sure they were not taking it too seriously surrounding, you know, before and after training. That was interesting. The other things, I think in particular, if we're going to talk about more specifically to triathlon and the longer distance running, I think one thing that I've definitely come to learn that I didn't really know before is how important long tempo running is. So all of the guys, more or less, I don't think I could think of any that aren't at the elite level, from 10K through to marathon, they're all doing threshold training, very, very long thresholds or tempo running on a weekly basis. That's not something I came from. I was a middle distance runner myself, so I was an 800 meter, 1500 meter runner, so the training is a little bit different. But I didn't really realize how, I guess, important that type of training was. And it's almost common sense to some people that have had their head in that or have been a marathon or a 10K runner for a long period of time. But I guess I do know of, for example, runners in Australia or in Europe that are on the cusp of being elite level that I think don't do long enough tempo runs. So, for example, they'll do 20 or 25 minutes or even 30-minute tempo runs, and there's absolutely no doubt that that's beneficial. But, you know, Mo Farah, Eliud Kipchoge, all of these guys that are really at the elite level of 10K through the marathon, they're doing tempo runs of over, you know, not all year, but when they're really looking to peak, they're doing tempo runs of an hour or up to, you know, in Kipchoge's case, 2 hours plus, with their heart rate at, you know, right around their anaerobic threshold zone. So that's, I think, more specifically talking about the training, something that's more common. You asked for 3 to 5 things. They're the two things I noted down, because they were really clear to me, the two sort of common things. Number one was the, you know, the attitude and atmosphere in the training environment, it being relaxed, fun, but also surrounded by very similar athletes to themselves. And two, talking more specifically about the training and focusing on the longer distance running events, the long tempo work that was, I guess, longer than I expected. I can't really think of anything else off my head that's clear cut in terms of similar across the board, so I'll leave it at those two. But I'm sure that some of the other questions that you asked later in this interview, we can come up with
some others anyway. Sure.
I think definitely the first point is the number one thing, because I see a lot of, even in my own friends, they sort of try and prepare for for a marathon, they might be shooting for a 220 or a 225 marathon, which is obviously pretty quick. And they try and do it without a training group around them and without a coach. And I sometimes think, yeah, that's possible. There's no doubt that that's doable, but it's tough. It's really hard mentally more than anything to have to motivate yourself to get out there and do it all on your own without any sort of support. And, you know, when I've spent some time with these elite running groups, it's clear to me how easy it is for them to turn up to training because it's just so much fun and so motivating.
Yeah, I think that for amateur athletes, it's sort of like the sad reality that you may not have the opportunity because of time commitments, etc., to join a training group. It's just simply an efficiency thing. You need to quickly be able to just get out the door and do a run or get on the indoor trainer. But the other thing that you mentioned there with not taking the training too seriously, I think that's something that a lot of amateur athletes get wrong. They take it too seriously and are too wrapped up in the outcomes of a single workout. And that's something that I think we can definitely learn from the elites.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one story that shot to my mind when you actually said that last thing was about 2 years ago now, I guess this is when Sweat Elite sort of got put on the map and people got to know about it. Myself and my colleague, who's one of the main writers, we went to Kenya and spent a month with Kipchoge's training group. And he does a long tempo run every Thursday, alternating between 30 kilometers 1 week and 40 kilometers the next week. And one run, it was a 40K run. They did it a lot slower than they normally do. So they normally run it at about sort of, I think their fastest is about 320, 322 per kilometer. And they normally run sort of somewhere between there and about 330, 335 per kilometer. And this 1 week, for whatever reason, they ran about 345 per kilometer, I think it was 343. It was quite a bit slower than normal. And at the end of it, we were a bit surprised at why it was so slow. And one of the athletes, we sort of asked one of the athletes, oh, you know, how'd you go? And they said, oh, we didn't go very fast today. And it's almost impossible for me to describe how he said it, but to try and summarize it in a couple of words, they didn't seem to care. they got the run done. It wasn't as good as they normally do it. Maybe from memory, this is almost 2 years ago now. It was a little bit windy, it was a little bit muddy, but it didn't faze them in the slightest that day wasn't as good as the week before. It was just they got the effort done. They put the effort into it. They got the distance done, and they just accepted it immediately that it wasn't their best training run, and they went inside and had a laugh and had their tea as they would normally. And I think what you just said before I told that story was people can get really hung up on a training session if they don't do it the way that they did it 2 weeks ago, or they're not improving or whatever. And that's something that's definitely not visible to me in the elite. They sort of make sure they get it done, and occasionally they will pop out a very impressive training session on the track or training run, but it's more about turning up and getting the consistency and not really judging each individual session.
When you mentioned there the athletes that have this like playful, not too serious approach, it struck me that all of the athletes that you mentioned, they have African heritage. And do you see the same thing in European Australian runners as well, that they don't take the training too seriously, they don't get too hung up on it? Or is it different, and it might that be an explanation for why the African or runners with African descent are dominating?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I do think that the Africans, I think it is part of their heritage, absolutely. I haven't spent a lot of time with European and Australian teams. I've been able to source through a number of different ways a lot of information about their training, which has been published on the website, but I haven't actually spent a lot of time with them. So I'm probably not the best person to ask that question. But I was a semi-elite 800-1500 meter runner. I never qualified for the Olympics, but I guess I was sort of close on a number of occasions. The groups that I was training with were somewhat like that, but nowhere near as much of a playful environment as what I saw over there. So I think that you're right with what you said, that I think it's part of their, you know, who they are and their heritage. But again, I'm not 100% sure, because it's not like I've gone and spent a month training with the top European runners. I've more so been able to talk with them over Skype, for example, or email, and get information and publish it.
Right.
So, yeah.
And if we talk about what you've seen, we talked about some common patterns, but where are the patterns ceasing to exist, where might philosophies differ, and even though runners still get a lot of success? And I guess this is about how there are many ways to skin a cat when it comes to training and just general approach to being a runner or endurance athlete. But have you seen any examples of that?
Yeah. So again, we do publish and study information on all the events. And I think in particular in the middle distance events, which I won't speak about too long because they're not too, they don't relate too much to the tribe, but there is quite a number of different philosophies in the middle distance events, that is 800 meters and 1500 meters, purely because of the energy systems. It's almost 50-50 anaerobic and aerobic. So there's a number of different schools of thought with how much 400 meter speed you need to run a fast 800. So there's the Arthur Lydiard approach where it's, you know, a whole lot of mileage and then sharpen up just before the peak race and your aerobic system carries you through. And then there's so the other school of thought, which I don't know if you put a coach's name on it, but there's a number of groups that do it that's more based on 400 meter speed. But when you go up to the 5K, 10K, half marathon and marathon, in particular half marathon and marathon, what's clear to me is the person's name that comes to mind, if you call it a philosophy, and his name is Renato Canova. That seems to be by far the most successful training method that we've come to understand. So Canova's method is basically on training at the right pace and slowly over time extending that pace out until you're able to run essentially almost the whole distance in training at very close to your race pace. As opposed to Lydiard, for example, who would start off and continue to run quite a long way off race pace but build your aerobic capacity off somewhat, I wouldn't call it slow running, but it's not very close to your race pace. So someone that's trying to run a 3-hour marathon, which is about 4:15 per kilometer. Following Canova's methods, you would be trying to run in training at least two times, possibly even three times a week, around that pace, and trying to slowly over time extend the duration or distance out that you can run at that pace. Whereas following Arthur Lydiard's method, you would be running at more like 4:45 or 5 minutes per kilometer and doing longer runs. Even very quickly getting up to sort of 30K, 35K, but not going too close. And then as the time gets closer to the event, you shorten those runs and try and come closer to race pace. And Lydiard's method, you know, does absolutely work for some people. But if we look at, you know, the top 50 times run by male and female in the half marathon and marathon and 10K, and we look at who coached them or who advised them, it's quite alarming, I guess, or surprising how many are advised by Renato Canova. And Eliud Kipchoge does fall into that camp, although he's not coached by Canova. He's coached by Patrick Sang. Patrick Sang just happens to be a very good friend of Canova, and they essentially share the same method. So, yeah, when we're talking about those, you know, distances of 10K through to the marathon, we've come to realize, or we came to realize very, very quickly when studying this, that method was by far the most successful amongst the elite end. And I do like the way that, you know, whenever I'm answering something, you're sort of trying to relate it more to the amateur side of things, which is something we Sweat Elite doesn't do very much, but I like to do it. It is a little bit tricky to be able to, or I'd love to discuss this with you, I guess. That method very well may not be the best for an amateur because it may be a recipe for injury. Of course, there's no black and white answer to that, but immediately going out at your race pace and trying to sort of extend that, you know, duration or distance in training, it's tough on the body. And a lot of these really good runners that are running these very quick times, sub 2:05 for the marathon or sub 1 hour for the half marathon for males, these guys have been training for a long time before they're really tackling this method properly. You know, whereas an amateur very well may be just starting out and researching this stuff, and it may not be the best thing for them to immediately jump into this sort of training. So, it's a tough one to relate to the amateur side of things, and I'm speaking purely from what we've researched though on the elite end.
Yeah, and another side that the thing that comes to mind is that on the amateur side, if your race pace for a marathon, for example, is basically very close to your easy run pace, then you don't get a quality workout if you're running at race pace. So maybe the best thing then to do is to actually do intervals that are significantly faster in race pace and actually just improve your physiology, your metabolism. Whereas for the elite runners, as you say, they are close to their anaerobic threshold when they do those sort of race pace runs. So they get the quality running in, and then of course on top of that they do a lot of very easy running. Yeah. And so that's a different, like, what race pace is and how intense it is and how much quality it is very different depending on your level. Exactly. And your ability as a runner and the distance that you're training.
That's
for.
Exactly right. Yes.
So what about but that's so coming back to the original question, then it seems to me then that there weren't anything really that you found that is where philosophies clash significantly, if you see that most of the top times are run on a Canova style training rather than Lydiard. We have the Lydiard approach, it exists, but it's not really used by the top runners or the top times, it seems.
Yeah, speaking more specifically about the 10K through the marathon, that's correct. I don't see a lot of philosophy clashing amongst the very elite end. If you take that down to the sub-elite end, I believe, which again, we haven't really studied, I'm just purely guessing this because I'm trying to currently run about a 2:30 marathon. So around my level, there seems to be a lot of different ideas. but when you look at the very top end, not so much. I think it's a method pretty much everywhere. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Can you talk about the mindsets of the top runners? We talked about how they have a playful approach to training and don't take it too seriously. Is there anything in addition to that with regard to training or just general approach to life and racing that you've found?
Yeah, the number one thing is what you just said. I think another thing, and it sounds very basic, but I think it's definitely worth pointing out. Most of the top guys have a very clear or a number of very clear goals in their mind. And again, this sounds very obvious and very easy to do yourself, but I think it's worth pointing out. So David Radishi, when we spent some time with him, his coach, who's a very famous coach in Kenya called Brother Colm, he kept telling us how I guess desperate in a way David Radishi was or motivated to win the Olympics and break the 800 meter world record. He had it up on his wall at home. He spoke about it constantly, not in an arrogant way, but he was so fixated on achieving this thing that he just didn't let it go. And he actually failed for a couple of years to get to the level that he wanted to. I guess 2010 and 2011 were not such great years for him. And then in 2012, when he actually broke the world record in the 800 meters and won the Olympics at the same time, it all sort of came to fruition. But the point was, for those sort of 4 to 5 years before 2012, he was just really fiercely fixated on this goal. Mo Farah was the same, from what I understand, leading up to the Olympics when he won the double at London. All he wanted to do for 3 or 4 years, he was very clear-cut in his mind, was to win in front of his home crowd, the 5K and the 10K. Eliud Kipchoge desperately wanted to win the 2016 Olympics for the marathon, and then after that he's been wanting to break 2 hours of marathon. And these guys have very clear-cut goals. There's no, I'm going to jump in this and hope for the best. Even though they may appear like that sometimes on interviews, I think they might not want to sound too arrogant, I'm not sure. But I know in their mind that the very top guys are very clear on what they want to achieve. And I don't see that a lot amongst people in general, I think, that are trying to do something. You occasionally do, but sometimes people are just sort of and that's fine. I mean, some people might not be sure about what they want to achieve. They might just want to finish an Ironman, for example, or finish a marathon. That's fine as well. But, looping back to the question you've asked, I think the mindset of these guys is all very similar. They're very clear on what they want. I think another thing is, and this sort of relates to mindset but sort of doesn't, is they're all very good at listening to their bodies in training. And if they have a problem, they deal with it very quickly. I noticed that across all of them as well. And it starts to make me wonder how many people there have been out there that could have possibly been as good as Mo Farah or as good as Eliud Kipchoge or as good as Radishi that didn't make it because they had consistent injuries or or they didn't listen to their body properly, so they burnt themselves out, for example. But one thing I did notice about all these top guys is they're very good at knowing, oh, I've got a, I'm a little bit cooked, I'm maybe overtraining a little bit, let's pull it back for a week or two and drop the mileage. That doesn't mean anything. I'm not going to lose any fitness by dropping from 180K to 130K for 2 or 3 weeks. Or I'm going to take 2 or 3 days off to deal with this niggling Achilles tendonitis or whatever it may be. And they don't tend to push it. I guess that what I'm trying to say is that they know when there's something slightly off that they need to pull back on. And they're very good at noticing what where that line is. Because, of course, you have to be training extremely hard to be achieving the things that they're achieving. So you have to be having that workload on you, and you can't just wake up and go, oh, I'm feeling a bit tired today, I have to take a day off. It's not like that. They're able to be aware of when something just feels a little bit off, and they deal with it very quickly. I think that's very important. So it's probably not answering your question exactly, but it is something that came to mind.
Well, that is an extremely important point, I think, because that's something that all of us can learn from. And I think both of those points, actually, you can boil them down to that they have a very long-term perspective to their training and improvement.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if you don't take time off when you feel a bit cooked, when you feel that you have a niggle coming on, then you might miss a few sessions over the next few days because of that. But over the long term, you will do so much many more training sessions than you would have otherwise if you get really injured or really overtrained. So, and the same thing with the goal. I think a lot of us amateurs, we set goals, but we might set a goal to complete an Ironman in 3 months' time. But these guys, they have a goal that lasts an entire Olympic cycle, to win the next Olympics. So, and that sets them up for success because they have the time to really do it properly over the time that endurance sports requires. It takes a long time and a lot of patience to really get to any significant goal.
Yes, exactly. And it reminds me of an article that's written on the Sweat Elite website by Alberto's. It's something that was brought up in an Alberto Salazar interview that we sort of highlighted, and it was about playing what you just said, about playing a long term game. And about not getting too caught up in thinking, oh, this marathon I'm training for in 2 months, I've got a bit of a niggle. I can't afford to miss two important training sessions because I might lose fitness for the marathon in 2 months, which is just ridiculous. And thinking more about, well, you know, I've actually got one or two more marathons this year that I have to get to as well, so I don't want to risk really making this injury much worse just to get to the start line of this one. So as you just pointed out, it is definitely about playing the long-term game. And I think I've noticed they're all very good at that.
Yeah. The next topic that I have to discuss is training intensity distributions. It's something that we've discussed quite a lot on this podcast, and in recent years there has been a lot of research on polarized training, for example. But it sounds already to me, and from what I've read on your website and read elsewhere about the Canova methods, for example, is that the training of the elite runners isn't very top heavy on speed work. It is a lot of tempo work, as you describe, long tempo runs. So how would you, can you elaborate a bit on the training intensity distribution and where it sits as it pertains to, I guess, what's discussed in this day and age in endurance sports in general?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Is Canova's training philosophy polarized or not? Because in a way, it sort of depends which way you look at it. In a way, it is a bit, but in a way, it's not. Because he does prescribe the 2 to 3 very, hard workouts in a week typically. And then he sort of adds in 1 or 2 progressive, what he calls progressive runs, which aren't a session and they're not an easy run. These progressive runs tend to be somewhere between 10 and 25 kilometers, typically maybe 15 or 20. And they'll be starting at an easy pace and progressing to, I guess, the last 5 to 10K at close to anaerobic threshold or at anaerobic threshold. And these sessions are definitely not what you would call, or these runs are not what you would call easy. But then in the training program, there are a lot of very easy 40 to 60 minute runs. So take the progressive runs out, it looks quite polarized. Add them in, it sort of looks a little bit sort of yes and sort of no. But then again, Canova also is quite good at looping back to the point we just spoke about 5 minutes ago at making sure the athlete listens to their body. And when I was in Kenya, I've been to Kenya a few times. One time I spoke
at length with Sondre Moen, who's he was the European marathon record holder until Mo Farah broke it. The Norwegian, he ran 2:05:40 something from memory, and he mentioned that he's trained by Canova, and he mentioned that Canova would always have a rough plan ahead of them, but he would always be very willing to adjust it depending on how Sondre was feeling. So if Sondre woke up one day and did an easy shakeout run in the morning of 30 or 40 minutes at 6 a.m. and they had another session planned for sort of 2 or 3 p.m. and Sondre just didn't feel right, they would do an easy to moderate run in the afternoon and push the other session forward. So Canova is quite good at not at adjusting the plan based on how athletes feel, and that's very important in my opinion across the board of all training for any endurance event. But yeah, back to the point of is it polarized or not? Well, sort of not. I don't think it really is, but at the same time, he almost can adjust to be a little bit more polarized based on how the athlete's feeling, if that makes sense. Because if the athlete is tired, he will make them rest a little bit more.
Yeah, I guess it's not a plan that you would expect to get good results from if you follow it strictly as is without acknowledging what you're feeling and whether you have any niggles, as we discussed already. But if you adjust it, if you are communicating with your coach and you are honest with yourself as well, then it can work. And it doesn't sound that it's polarized, for sure not. But again, it comes down to what we talked about previously. There are, in some cases, many ways to skin a cat. And well, this is on the elite, and it seems the best way to skin the marathon or distance running cat in general.
Yeah. And as I sort of said about 10 minutes ago, these athletes can possibly handle, or they definitely can, they've been training so much for so long that they're able to handle 2 to 3 very hard workouts in a week and 2 to 3 moderate to hard progressive runs in a week and the rest easy. Whereas if you try to give that to someone that started running 2 or 3 years ago, you know, it's a recipe for a stress fracture or tendonitis very quickly. So, you know, and we do try and point out in our articles from time to time, maybe not arguably not enough, you know, don't necessarily think this is the best way for everyone. This is just what the elites are doing. And I think Canova does point that out quite a bit in his, he tends to blog quite a bit on Let's Run.
Yeah.
And he does point that I've read him say that a few times when he's like, this is what these guys do. But remember, these Kenyans are 26 and they've been running over 100, they've been running 100 kilometers a week or close to it from the age of 15 to 20 and then 140 to 180 kilometers a week after that. So they're so strong that they're able to handle this sort of training now. So that's important to consider as well.
Yeah. And how much do they actually run significantly faster than marathon pace, if we're talking about marathoners, for example? Or let's just talk about anaerobic threshold. Do they do a lot of speed work above anaerobic threshold, or is it mostly capped around that anaerobic threshold sort of level?
Canova's philosophy seems to normally include at least one session per week of intervals that are faster than anaerobic threshold. So it's from what he calls about 110 I think about 108 to 115% from memory of marathon pace, and of course it's difficult to work out. But it's normally I guess close to 5K or 10K pace, and so that is slightly above anaerobic threshold. And those intervals may be 400 meter repeats, 1K repeats, or 600s. The volume of that specific interval session, so it tends to be on the track, it tends to be around once a week, maybe or sometimes two times in a 3 week period. The total volume tends to be between about 8 and 12 kilometers worth of intervals, that is. And that can be – I've seen a lot of different examples of his sessions. There doesn't seem to be a staple 2 or 3. But I have seen, for example, 25 times 400. I've seen 10 times 1K. I've seen sort of different distances in the session. So I've seen some sets of 1Ks and then some sets of 400s in the same session, that is. So maybe something like 5 by 1K and 10 by 400. But it tends to, it always, the pattern I see there is that it tends to be at about 5 to 10K pace,
around 8 to 12 kilometers worth of total volume. The recovery always tends to be around 200 meters jog, so about 1.5 to 2 minutes. And I have read often that that's not specifically timed. Sometimes it is, but it's often not. That's the recovery, that is. So yeah, to answer your question, that is something above anaerobic threshold pace, and I don't see it in Canova's methods much more than once a week.
And on that note, in your articles about Eliud Kipchoge, one thing that really stood out to me is that you commented that he never seems to be maximally exerted, even in these sessions that sound pretty hard. Is this something that is just Eliud, or is it common with most of the top runners?
I actually do think it's somewhat unique to him, because Farah trains very hard. I've never asked him the question, do you actually push yourself to the limit in training? But it certainly appears like he does. David Radisha definitely does from time to time. I would say normally one, he seems to be, I'm not sure if he's retired or not now, but he hasn't raced for a while. This is the 800 meter world record holder again. And why I keep mentioning Radisha is I spent 6 weeks training with that group. He trains very hard, 1 to 2 times a week to the limit, to the point where he's, you know, lying on his back for 5 minutes after the last rep. So I do think it is unique to Kipchoge in a way. We mentioned that, and then some people even questioned that when we published that. Oh, does he really? Or maybe he's just good at hiding that he's hurting. But NN Running Team have mentioned a few times on their social media channels that he doesn't push himself to the limit. And it was even quoted somewhere, I think it was on Instagram, that so I think someone asked in an Instagram Q&A, I think it was, do the athletes in Kipchoge's group run 100% in training? And the answer was something along the lines of, no, they limit at 90% and they save the rest for the race.
Yeah.
So I think that is somewhat unique to him. And when we watched him train, we watched him train a number of times, track sessions, interval sessions, tempo runs. He works very hard, but we never saw him red line. Like, we never saw him really struggle and be on, you know, on his knees or anything like that. He was always very quickly into a jog. This is after the last repetition. When he finished the last repetition or the last kilometer of any run or interval, he was able to essentially jog straight away. So that tells you that he's not at his limit.
Yeah, I think there are different schools of thought here for sure. I definitely agree with Eliud's thinking that it, saving the 100% push for the race and going very hard but not at your maximum in training. And I see that in quite a lot of the professional triathlon coaches as well. We talked a bit before the interview, and I mentioned that I recommend you listen to the interview I did with Joel Filial, who's one of the most successful coaches, and they do the same thing, in particular in running, that they prescribe speed limits essentially for the runners in, or for the triathletes in their squad. And it's not just him. There are many other coaches that do that, even though for sure there are a lot of triathletes that will do the David Radisha style as well and be completely knackered after their session. So it's not as if there is a one and only way to do things. But it's interesting to hear how different people approach their sessions.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think there's definitely not one way to do it. And what works for Kipchoge may not work for Farah, and what works for Farah may not work for Kipchoge, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, one main thing that we've definitely learned since starting this website is there's definitely not one way to do anything with running. Definitely certain things and I guess ideas suit some people and other things suit others. So because, for example, some coaches just believe that becoming more flexible has helped their athletes, and Kipchoge is one of the least flexible people I've ever seen. So, you know, you got a question, you know, but I have honestly heard that of some pretty good, I can't even remember who it was, but I have heard of coaches and athletes saying that when they focus on doing more stretching, it has helped them. And you got to think that could be true, but then, you know, then you've got Kipchoge that can't even, you know, even nearly touch his toes if he tries to stretch his hamstrings. So it's, yeah, there's not one way to do it. And I think that's potentially one reason why it's such an exciting and interesting space, that not only running, but triathlon. There's just so many ways to do it, and finding the way that suits you best is a puzzle, and it's an exciting one.
Yeah, yeah, that's also a large part of the role of coach to find the right way for individual athletes and not put a cookie cutter plan on the athlete that they're supposed to coach individually. So finding the right approach for this particular individual. But speaking about the flexibility, yes. And what kind of like strength and conditioning and other supplemental training do elite runners do? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this is probably the one space that's probably the most varied. So, you know, we spoke about training, specifically running methods and the long threshold work and the race pace work being very common across the board. Strength training and flexibility seems to be very varied. So Kipchoge's camp do not do any strength training in the 12 weeks leading into a marathon. Although saying that, it sounds like and it looks like they're doing a little bit of core work now. Which I think is new to them, but weight, like in terms of strength and weights, they do a block of weight training before their specific period starts. So the specific period is the final 12 weeks before a marathon, and they do around 6 to 8 weeks, 2 to 3 times per week in the gym, where they do quite lightweight work, general strength, a lot of. There's a really cool video actually on the NN Running Team Facebook page, I think it is, or it could even be on YouTube, and it shows them in the gym doing some exercises and some weights. It doesn't appear that they do anything very heavy, but in the 12 weeks leading into the marathon, they don't do any weights at all. Confirmed, we asked a few people that, and they said they don't do any. Whereas Mo Farah does very heavy weights, or at least he did when he was racing 5K and 10K. And he was training with Alberto Salazar. So he would spend 2 sessions a week in the gym, and they would be doing heavy squats, a lot of calf work, calf raises with weights, some plyometric exercises. So, yeah, there's 2 very different methods there. Radish's group, surprisingly, being a super quick 200-meter, 400-meter runner. He's an 800-meter runner, but he's very fast over the distances. Shorter than that, he did very little strength work. They did a lot of plyometric work, so just on the ground, bounding and so on, but they didn't use any weights. And some of the other top athletes, some that I know of do a lot of sort of very heavy lifting, and some don't do any at all. So that's something that's really varied. And something that I've never really quite found any pattern with, because it's going back to the point we spoke about a few minutes ago, I guess some things work for some people and some things, you know, work for others. So I don't think there seems to be a clear answer there. And I think it's something worth experimenting with under the guidance of a professional, maybe trialing, doing some weights for a 3 to 6 month period. You probably won't see any benefit in doing for less time than that. But yeah, there doesn't seem to be a specific training session strength training plan that I've seen that works for distance runners, because Kipchoge does very little heavy lifting, yeah. And so does David Radisha for that matter. So yeah, flexibility wise, I guess the same thing. Kipchoge's group did very little of it. Radisha's group did quite a bit of it after training. They did a lot of stretching. Farah's group, I'm not sure. I think they did sort of a bit of it, but not a lot. I never really asked him about stretching that much, though. So again, pretty varied. So both the strength work and the flexibility work seems to be fairly individual and varied. So no clear answer there in the elite space.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving on, how do these athletes use, if they do use, which I think that they might not, but data in their training? Do they run with heart rate monitors and pace, or is it just pure running on the dirt roads up at altitude in Kenya? And how are their sessions prescribed by their coaches?
So I love this question, and I love speaking about it because it's super interesting, because I quite like data, and I really understand why people like data. It's a way to track what you're doing. It's a way to compare your sessions in detail to what you did, say, a month ago or a year ago. It's a great way to compare yourself to others. And there's so many numbers and figures there to track in terms of lactate thresholds, lactate figures, mind blanking the name, but when you sort of prick yourself and you measure your lactate levels, heart rates, there's all these things. But in Kenya specifically, and I guess also Ethiopia, we went there earlier this year, a lot of them don't even wear a watch, like let alone a heart rate monitor and measuring lactate levels. Like these guys run purely on feel, and I think that really works for them. So I was fortunate enough, and I've touched on this already a few times, but to race the middle distance events for quite some time, and I went through a fairly lengthy period in the middle of my career where I didn't race very well. So I ran my personal best at about the age of 20. This is about 800 meters at about 21, and then I sort of plateaued for a few years. And I went over to Europe and I raced a lot of Africans when I was over there. And one thing that became very clear to me in that time when I was racing against the Africans was how clueless they were about like their splits and how fast they were running and what was going on in the race. And all they really wanted to do was win the race. And it came to a, it made me realize after a while how powerful this can be and how detrimental it can be when you're in the middle of a race and you're looking at your splits thinking, oh, that's too fast or that's too slow or I'm not feeling good for this pace. I think that can have a huge impact on how you actually feel. So I'm going a little bit far away from your original question, but it does loop back. Tracking your data like really intensely I think can be good in many ways, but one thing I've really noticed in at least the high-end, like the elite Africans, they don't really track it at all. So when you're looking at Kipchoge preparing for the sub-2-hour marathon attempt, yes, there is quite a bit of data being tracked there because they're doing a whole lot of testing for a number of reasons. But in general, when he's preparing for a normal marathon, he's not under the Nike or Ineos, all this testing. They do very little tracking of data. So Kipchoge, of course, has a GPS watch and he takes notice of his pace and he has goals in his training pace-wise. But they... when they're running these tempo runs, they don't really look at their splits very much. They don't get too hung up on they wouldn't. I highly doubt they have a clue what their heart rate is doing. Farah is very similar. Radish is very similar, and a lot of the really good athletes that at least come out of Africa spend very little time tracking and thinking about their data. When you move over to the US and Europe, it's a little bit different, I think, just purely because of the culture. There is a little bit more of that, but I think there's definitely something to be said for running free. And what I mean by that is not getting too fixated on heart rate zones, paces, and all these sort of things, because I think in some regards it can restrict you in a way. And that's like a deep sort of subconscious, mental thing. It's like if your heart rates, I hope you can understand what I mean by that. Like if you're purely just looking at your heart rate all the time and thinking about what your pace is relative to your heart rate, like you can almost lose track of just running for how you feel. And I think that there's definitely something to be said for that because, I mean, if you look at all the top guys, they're not tracking that. Or at least in Africa, that is, they're not tracking that at all. And I think that they're really focused on winning, beating as many people as possible. And when that's all you're fixated on, you're not really thinking about, oh, is the pace too fast? Is it too slow for me? And panicking and letting all these sort of mental games happen in your own mind. They just tend to just unleash and just get the most out of themselves. So yeah, very little data tracking at the top end, at least in Africa. I think a little bit more in sort of the Western world, but at the same time, I do know of groups in Australia, at least that sort of the best running group here, Melbourne Track Club, who have quite a few Olympic representatives in the longer distance events. They do a little bit of tracking of heart rate in threshold runs, but they don't. They are very. They do really think a lot about trying to run free and trying to win races and beat as many people as possible and not get too hung up on splits and times and what all this data means when they're in the middle of races, because that can play on your mind a lot, I think, and it can almost restrict you in some ways. So I hope I'm not, for the people out there that are very into the data side of things, I'm not necessarily saying that's the wrong way to do it, because I'll be honest and say I'm actually not very knowledgeable in that space. But I have noticed that amongst the elite guys that I've been at least taking notice of, they do tend to restrict to some extent how much data they track, because they want to just run by how they feel a lot of the time.
I think that Mo Farah is a very interesting example there, because he's being trained in the United Kingdom and then later on in the United States, which you would suppose to be that they are supposed to be like tech savvy countries, and he must have had a lot of coaches that are quite modern. Obviously Salazar, I don't know that much about Salazar in the details about how he prescribes sessions or anything like that, but just from being in the United Kingdom and the United States, you would think that even though he's of African heritage, he might be somebody who uses data a bit more. But again, that goes to show what you're saying, that they don't really care too much about it and enjoy running free quite a lot. And I think definitely everybody needs to learn how to do any run at just a perceived effort. I actually, just yesterday, I did my tempo run with just a stopwatch. I had a long run with 4x18 minutes, and my Garmin has been giving me some problems. Sometimes it charges, sometimes it doesn't charge. And these last few days have been days where it doesn't charge, so it was out of battery. So I just took my stopwatch and went for a run, and it was brilliant. I actually enjoy it a lot when I do that, because it also takes the pressure off from, even though I try to not look at splits when I'm training, I just look at them afterwards. I do like that side of data, to be able to look at what you did after the fact. But sometimes you do cheat during training and look at what you're doing, and then it adds an extra layer of pressure that doesn't necessarily make the training more effective. On the contrary, in many cases, I think.
Yeah, 100%, exactly. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I do what you did. Was it yesterday, the tempo run? I do that from time to time as well, and just don't run with a GPS watch. I just run with a stopwatch, and I actually tend to really enjoy those sessions as well. Just run purely to how you feel, and yeah, I think it's definitely worth doing from time to time.
So how do their coaches prescribe sessions? You mentioned there, Kanoa talking about 110% of marathon pace for the track sessions, but is it more so that they're just giving a distance and a description, like tempo or progressive tempo, or 25x400 at 5K or 10K pace perhaps for that kind of session, but or what do they look like? Do you know that, the details of the program?
Yeah, Kanoa tends to use the two ideas of a percentage of race pace. So, you know, long runs for him are obviously quite fast. So he tends to do a lot of prescribed long runs at 90 to 95% of marathon pace. Or he'll use the idea of a goal pace, so 10K pace or 5K pace. I think that's very common for coaches to be prescribing sessions based on a goal pace. But yeah, some others just do prescribe a threshold run, so that won't necessarily be at a certain pace. That will just be at that lactic lactate threshold pace, which is what most of the top athletes know how to do without even running with a heart rate monitor or a GPS watch. They'll just know how that feels. And some other coaches may prescribe it just based on a time. So they may say, okay, well, we're doing 10 times 1 kilometer with 1 minute rest, and we're trying to run them in 250. If you equate that very well may be their 10K pace, but they might not actually call it that. So yeah, it is a broad question, and some coaches prescribe it one way and some another. But I think I do coach quite a lot of people at the moment, and I tend to like the idea of prescribing it based on a goal pace. So the session may be 5x1K at 10K pace, and then 10x400 meters at 5K pace, for example, and that pace will be their goal pace that, for example, that year. I like to do it that way, but yeah, there is no clear cut answer there, and it really depends on the coach. But as I said, Kanoa tends to do a percentage of race pace or goal pace, and others just prescribe a time.
Yeah. So since you mentioned your coaching there, you have the coaching and you can find the details on the website for the listeners that we'll link to in the show notes. You also have training plans from 5K to the marathon. And I'm curious about what aspects of the elite training findings that you made have you incorporated into these training plans, and what aspects have you not incorporated? As we talked about, some of these things may not be applicable to amateurs, whereas some of them will be. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, most of the training plans are based on Canova's methods, just really kind of dialed down, not so intense. So we don't tend to add in so much of the progressive runs, although I am a fan of them for people that can handle that sort of volume. But a lot of the training sessions are sort of based around what Canova prescribes. They are based on percentage of race pace or, as I said, a goal pace. We do mention in the plans, we tend to give people an option. So for example, it'll be 6 to 10 times 1K, and it'll mention that if you're able to, it depends on how sort of where you are at your own running journey. If you've been running for a long period of time, you might be able to handle the upper end of that. If not, the lower end of that. So in general, it's sort of based around Canova's philosophy. But it's just there are certain intensities that are dialed down a bit. There are certain runs that are cut out. That is mostly the progressive runs. But the long runs are still pretty much the same. They're very close to goal marathon pace. That is if you're doing the marathon training plan. But they might not be quite as long as what Canova prescribes. So Canova likes to get right up to 40 or even over 40K for those long runs. And people that have been running for maybe, you know, 5+ years could do that. Otherwise, you might want to sort of top out at, you know, 34 or 35K. So it gives people the option in there to decide what they want to do, but it gives people at least a framework. And I think that the value in those training plans are only $39, so they're not a huge investment, is giving people structure. Some people just, you know, read all this information and go, okay, well, I know sort of what's going on now, but I want to have sort of a structure here and just a guide. I think that's the main reason why that's quite good. And of course, there are lots of free guides out there, but I guess this one includes a lot of tips and I guess just motivational quotes and information within the training plan from elite athletes, but it is based around Canova's philosophy as well. So yeah, they are quite popular, especially the marathon one. We tend to get a lot of people buy that one. And from what I understand, people have raced well off it. So yeah.
Fantastic. In that 35 kilometer like peak long run for the marathon, how much of that would be at close to marathon pace, and what is close to marathon pace in this context?
Yeah, normally we would sort of say the first 1 or 2 kilometers would just be a warm up, so it would just be essentially a jog or a little bit faster, and then it would up until about halfway into the run, you'd be running at about 80 to 85% of your goal marathon pace. So to work that out, if your goal marathon pace is 4 minutes per kilometer, that's very roughly about 440, I think, approximately 430 to 440 for the first half. And then you want to be getting down to 90 to 95% of your goal marathon pace in the final, progressively getting down to it in the final 15 kilometers. So, you know, a little bit, not quite the whole second half, but very close to it. So that would be more like 415 to 410 per kilometer.
Yeah.
And we do, I think we mentioned in there anyway, but if we don't, I do prescribe it to the people that I individually coach, that if you feel good and you feel able to handle it, try and actually run at your goal marathon pace for the last 5K.
Yeah.
And I do that in my own training. If I can, some runs I'm not able to. So my goal, I'm trying to run this year as a sub 230 marathon. And so my goal pace is about 332, I think, per kilometer. So some days I'm able to handle that in the last 5Ks, and some days I just can't. Like I'll do when I'm 5K to go, I'll do 1 or 2K there, and then I'm really struggling, so I need to pull it back to 340 or 345. So yeah, it just sort of depends on how you're feeling. But if you're able to, I do try and advise people to touch on that goal pace in the last few kilometers if possible. Mm.
And the thing that you mentioned there at the beginning as well, with the Kenya running experience that you have, can you talk about that as well? That's something that I've had actually on my bucket list for a long time. I would love to go out to Kenya and experience running there.
Yeah, I mean, anyone can go to Kenya, obviously, on their own. But I think the reason why we created a training camp / tour, which is what the Kenya Running Experience is because a lot of people just didn't want to go on their own. And they also didn't really know how to get there and where to stay and how to do it all, because the internet doesn't have a lot of information, although we have published an article about that for people that want to do it themselves. But some people just don't really want to go there and train on their own. So we put together, I guess, a camp or a tour. I guess it's very similar to someone wanting to travel to if you're in Europe, travel to the US, but you haven't got anyone to go with and you want to join other people. You know, there's obviously tour groups. So we wanted to essentially, like Kentucky Tour or Trafalgar or whatever, we wanted to essentially create the same idea but as a Kenyan running experience. And as part of that, we also I've been very fortunate enough to have met quite a lot of very good Kenyan runners and even European and American runners that are based in and Australian and Kiwi runners that are based in Kenya. So I'm able to ask them to come and sit with us at a cafe, for example, for an hour and have a Q&A. So there, that's a big part of the Kenya Running Experience. We try and do at least five of them per week, where we sit down with, for example, Sondre Moen and Julian Wonders joined us on the last one. Brother Colm also did, David Radish's coach. So we had 1 to 2 hour Q&As with these really good athletes, and the people that came along absolutely loved that, not only just to meet them, but to be able to pick their brain about what they, you know, how they live and what they do in training. But being a coach myself, I also create obviously the training plan that week. So it's quite loosely structured so that people can choose to do their own sessions if they want to. But, you know, we do a tempo run together on Tuesday and then an interval session on Thursday and then a long run on the weekend. If you're thinking about going to Kenya and training and you feel like you're able to do it yourself, I strongly recommend doing that. And there's a great article on our website that can guide you and put you in the right direction as to where to stay and so on. But if you like the idea of sort of joining in on some of the activities I just mentioned, then you might want to put your name down on our website for the next one. So the actual next one has closed now and it's starting in a couple of weeks. I'm heading over to Kenya at the end of this month. But we'll probably do another one about mid next year. So we've only been doing one a year so far, but it may increase it to a year. We'll see.
Yeah. And during that time, do you live in sort of like the athletes are doing in some sort of like how does that work?
That's the only thing we don't really, I guess we should, but if you want to live like a local there, it's tough. It really is. I mean, you know,
it's cold water out of a bucket for your shower and
yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, it really is. Like we stay at the high altitude training center, which is I guess it's by far the best, the highest quality hotel in that area by far, but it's probably the equivalent of about a 3-star hotel in Europe. Very good gym, by the way. Very good gym, track and pool. The rooms they're okay. They're about a 3-star standard. But outside of that, yeah, you really are. You'll struggle to find a hot shower, sort of thing. You may sleep on a very uncomfortable bed. But inside the high altitude training center, which is where we stay, it's fairly comfortable. So yeah, that's the issue. I mean, if you want to really live like a local, you've got to be game. Like you've got to be ready for an uncomfortable sleep and a cold shower or maybe no shower. It's rough how they do it. I mean, they've grown up there and lived that way their whole life, so they don't really know any better. But for us fortunate people, in Europe or Australia or the US that have hot showers and taps that run that have drinking water coming out of them, you know, it's a big change to go and live like a local over there. So no, to answer the question, we stay at the high altitude training center, which is a pretty good hotel.
Yeah. To wrap things up, if you would recommend your top three favorite articles on sweatelite.co to a new reader, what would they be?
Yep, good question. I had to think hard about this one because there's a lot of articles that I really like to read. But I think one of my favorite ones that I've read a lot is it's called Eliud Kipchoge Outsiders. So it's basically an article written by my colleague Tate who spent a month with me training with Kipchoge, and it's an article about the lifestyle of the people that train with Kipchoge that haven't quite made the elite level yet. So they don't actually have sponsors. They don't have any funding, but they turn up every day to train with Kipchoge's group anyway. We spent quite a bit of time with some of those guys that live on, you know, $2 or $3 a day. They don't have, they have very little. They often have to do jobs like shine shoes during the day, or, you know, or farming jobs, or something just to get by. But they're just doing everything they can to get up to Kipchoge's level. The article is very well written, just about their lifestyle and what it's like for them. One of the all-time, by far, our article that's had the most views, I think it's had almost 3 million views, is Kipchoge's training log leading into Berlin Marathon. That's definitely one that people should check out, just because it's just fascinating how much quality, you know, how impressive his training is in general, and just how much he's able to handle. And I think another good one is an article called Training for a Sub-205 Marathon. It's basically an article about Renato Canova's philosophy in detail. So anyone that's not clear about Renato Canova's philosophy after what we've talked about over the last hour or so, because we sort of did, bounce around from different ideas, it's all in detail in that article. And the reason for the topic, the title of that article like that, is that if you look at the sub-205 marathon results of all time, I think something like 92% of them, or something like that, came from, were either coached by or influenced in some way by Canova. So Canova has coached most of the sub-205 male marathon results. So probably those three. Eliud Kipchoge, outsiders. Eliud Kipchoge's training log leading into Berlin Marathon 2017, and training for a sub-205 marathon, which is basically Renato Canova's training philosophy in detail.
Yeah, and we'll link to those in the show notes as well. And finally, to finish off the rapid fire questions, and I actually have a coaching call with an athlete in 3 minutes, so we really need to make this rapid fire game. And the first
one is very short.
Yeah, the first one is: what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to running or endurance sports?
Hal Higdon's book, called very old, 1999. It was written, called Marathon: The Ultimate Training Guide. It's a very good book.
What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Two, I'll be very quick with them both. One is the 10-minute rule. So if you don't feel like do anything, do it just for 10 minutes, and then your brain will trick you, and then you'll realize you can just keep doing it for longer. Sometimes I don't feel like running, but I say go and run for 10 minutes, and then I end up running for an hour. Number two is putting goals in public. So if I want to achieve a goal, I state it publicly somewhere. That's definitely helped as well.
I love both of those, but in particular the 10-minute rule. Wow, that's super, super. I guess that's sneaky, but great.
It works very well, especially with accounting. If you don't feel like doing any accounting, just do it for 10 minutes, then you'll end up just finishing it off.
I really needed that specifically. And finally, who's somebody in running or endurance sports that you look up to?
It's very hard to go past Eliud Kipchoge, just because of what he's doing for the sport. But I do want to say, because this is the triathlon podcast, that spending that about 5 months with Jan Frodeno living with him before he won the Olympics was very special. And I do really look up to him, because I was able to sort of do a bit of running with him before he was just the superstar that he is. And I really look up to him as well.
Yeah. Finally, where can people find you on the internet and on social media?
I'm not very exciting, but I guess the brand Sweat Elite is on Instagram and Facebook. So if you just search Sweat Elite in both of those two, we don't do anything on Twitter at the moment, but Sweat Elite on Instagram, which is the handle at Sweat Elite. And then if you type Sweat Elite into Facebook, you'll find us there as well. We publish a lot of information for free on both of those, by the way. People that just are real, nerds like me about running, you might want to look at the website and maybe subscribe if you're up to it. But if you just want to, a little bit of information here and there, the social media channels will give you that.
Yeah, I think the subscription is $1 per week or something like that, if I recall correctly.
So yeah,
it's well worth it. It's a couple of cups.
Yeah, that's right. We'd like to say about that, because it is $1 a week. It's billed in 3 month increments. But it's, you know, if you really, you know, compare it to what that real cost is, it's, you know, cost of a lunch really, every 3 months. So if you want to learn, you know, a lot about running, I think it is worth the money. And there's been quite a few thousand people that have thought that too. So yeah, I'm very, very fortunate to have been able to create this, and I'm very happy to hear that subscribers enjoy it.
Yeah, brilliant.
But you better get to your coaching call.
Yeah, I'll go now. Thank you so much, Matt. It was a pleasure having you on, and keep up the great work with Sweat Elite.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was a really interesting talk, I think, about the training, the habits and the routines of the best runners in the world. And to me, the most important takeaway is that there are patterns, there are a lot of similarities, but there is not one single right answer. For example, these African runners, they run 100 kilometers per week from their young teenage years. And that means that they can handle this massive training load that they are doing with both volume and intensity. And it seems that they do a lot more hard or moderately hard running than what we talked about, for example, in the interview with Steven Seiler on polarized training. And they might not actually be, as we discussed, they are probably not following that model, which just goes to show that we should never approach training or coaching with a dogmatic view or a formulaic view of what is the right way, because it is individual. So if you, as a listener, are somebody who grew up in these conditions that that Kenyan and Ethiopian runners did, and from an early age have built up this massive base of running, then maybe you can handle this sort of training yourself. Or if you're a coach coaching this kind of runner, then the quote-unquote polarized training formula might not be the best thing to apply to your athlete. So avoid dogmatic views on training. Remember that it's all individual. And if you want to run a sub-205 marathon, then it seems that things like 30 to 40 kilometer tempo runs seem to be the name of the game. Not necessarily the case if you are trying to qualify for Boston or something like that. But I guess that the take-home message here is that we can definitely learn a lot from the elites, and we can model some things, but we shouldn't copy anything. So model, but don't copy, and consider your individual circumstances. The other really, really important thing, in my opinion, was the mindset of these great running champions, of not taking training too seriously and not getting hung up on the outcome of a session. Race day is where it matters, and the training leading up to it is about going through a process and putting in the effort, but no need to get hung up on the outcome of the individual workouts. And finally, the long-term approach. These runners have very clear-cut long-term goals, but also the long-term perspective of listening to your body, take an easy day or a day off if needed, if that means that you will be able to long-term have a better training period, training build leading into a marathon, because you won't get injured or you won't get overtrained. Finally, make sure that you go and check out Sweat Elite on sweatelite.co. They have tons of great articles. They have a great newsletter, a lot of free content. I think you can access a couple of articles per month for free. But in my opinion, it's well worth spending the very minimal amount of money of a subscription, if nothing else, to give back a bit for all the money, time and effort put in by Matt and the team in keeping the website going and producing really, really great quality content. For this episode, as usual, you can find the show notes and links to articles mentioned on thattriathlonshow.com. And in the next episode, I interview Melanie McQuaid, who is a Canadian elite triathlete and coach. She is a five-time world champion in Xterra and ITU cross-triathlon events. And we will discuss training for off-road triathlon or Xterra triathlon, and also racing in those events, getting into things like gear and stuff. So it will be very interesting for those athletes that are focusing on this part of triathlon, which actually we haven't covered before on the podcast specifically. But I will make sure to ask some general training questions as well. So even if Xterra doesn't interest you in the slightest, you will definitely get something from that interview anyway. If you enjoy the podcast and get a lot of value from it, please help me grow it by spreading the word, telling your friends, telling your training partners, your frenemies in triathlon racing or endurance racing in general about it. Remember that it's not just for triathletes, cyclists and runners and swimmers and other endurance athletes all benefit. And I see it time and time again in emails that I get, that everybody from rowers to cross-country skiers seem to be listening to particular episodes, not necessarily about swimming technique or things like that, but the general endurance things, as we discussed with Matt as well, they do remain the same in large part, at least. So don't think that this podcast is just for triathletes. Tell all your friends that are into endurance sports about it, and I would really appreciate that. Big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. You can get 20% off your entire order with the promo code TTS, all caps. And thank you to Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. get 20% off your order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW20, or get your first box or tube for free with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all caps. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlons.